You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 26th of February 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show,
the comments of both Secretary of State Kerry and National Security Advisor Susan Rice are saddening, are an expression of the crisis in the relationship.
Isaac Herzog, Benjamin Netanyahu's chief political rival, laments a setback in Israel-US relations after American officials questioned Netanyahu's judgment of their efforts to secure an Iranian nuclear deal. Our guests Samira Shackle and Daniela Peled are in the studio to give their view. Also on today's agenda, Austria's amended law on Islam and Syriza's approach to immigration in Greece. Plus, we'll have a review of the weekly French printed press, a North Korean tale of kidnap, and our book review with Granters and Meadows. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. But ahead of all that, Paul Osborne is here with the latest world news.
A friend of the man named publicly today as the Islamic State extremist dubbed by the media Jihadi John says he was repeatedly questioned by British security services. Mohammed Emwazi is a Kuwaiti-born Briton from West London. He is believed to be the man seen wielding a knife in video showing the killings of a number of IS hostages. Asim Qureshi from the advocacy group CAGE first met Emwazi 6 years ago and says he was questioned after returning from a trip to Tanzania when he was accused of planning to join the radical group Al-Shabaab in Somalia.
The Mohammed that I knew was extremely kind, extremely gentle, extremely soft-spoken, was the most humble young person that I knew. You know, when I'm asked, is the person that you see on those videos the same as the person you remember, Mohammed Emwazi, it's difficult for me to say that, yes, these two people are exactly the same.
A new IS video has emerged today in which militants appear to destroy ancient artifacts in a museum in the northern Iraqi city of Mosul. The 5-minute video shows men using hammers and drills to destroy a number of statues, some dating back to the 7th century BC. And one person on the video says the group, the artifacts are false idols banned under their interpretation of Islam. Ukraine's government says its army is starting to withdraw heavy weapons from the front line in the east of the country. It's a key part of the ceasefire deal agreed earlier this month. Pro-Russian rebels claim they've already removed 80% of their heavy weapons, creating a buffer zone, though this hasn't been independently confirmed by monitors. Israel's prime minister has been accused of harming the country's most important relationship in a deepening row with the United States. The U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has questioned Benjamin Netanyahu's judgment after he accused America and other nations of giving up in efforts to stop Iran developing nuclear weapons. He is due to speak at the U.S. Congress next week, invited by the Republicans, in a move that's angered the White House. The leader of Israel's centre-left coalition said Mr. Netanyahu's harmed Israel's interests. And Yossi Meckelberg from the think tank Chatham House says it'll all depend on the content of his speech.
Would you resist temptation actually to be a bit pettier than that and play all sort of cheap points in Israeli elections and against Obama? I doubt it. And I think he will need to sit with advisor and speech writers and decide how statesmanlike is this speech going to be.
The UN and dozens of other aid agencies have issued a joint statement criticizing the slow pace of reconstruction work in Gaza. It's 6 months since the end of the conflict there. The statement says around 100,000 people were displaced, with 10,000 still sheltering in UN-run schools, and many more forced to live with family or friends. More than 200 people are now known to have died in a series of avalanches in the northeast of Afghanistan. They were caused by heavy snowfalls, which are continuing in Panjshir province. Rescuers are struggling to reach the worst affected areas, with many remote villages cut off by the snow. Australia's Prime Minister has held talks with Indonesia's President about the looming executions of two convicted Australian drug traffickers. Tony Abbott's earlier comments had angered Joko Widodo's administration. He had linked pleas for clemency to Australia's support for Indonesia after the tsunami in 2004. Mr. Abbott says he's still hoping the lives of the two Australians will be spared.
I don't think it would help the case of these two young Australians if I was to start ventilating in public the contents of the conversation suffice to say that the president absolutely understands our position, absolutely understands our position, and I think he is carefully considering Indonesia's position.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. This is Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And you are listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 18.06, 13.06 in New York. Joining me now with their take on today's news. Here in the studio, we have the journalist and commentator Samira Shackle and Daniela Peled, editor at the Institute of War and Peace Reporting, contributor to Haaretz and others. Welcome both. We will start tonight with a diverting diplomatic novelty, a row between the usually inseparable United States and Israel. US Secretary of State John Kerry has gone so far as to say Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu may not be correct in his accusation that the rest of the world has given up caring whether or not Iran ever acquires nuclear weapons. Daniela, I'll ask you first, may not be correct. How does that translate from diplo speak into English? How serious is this?
I think that's pretty damning in diplo speak.
It's pick a window, basically, isn't it?
This is not uncharacteristic for this particular administration's relationship with the other administration's relationship. Netanyahu has actually, to be fair, he's been successful in his successive administrations in not getting on too well with the White House. Relationships with the Obama administration are really going from bad to worse. I mean, this kind of criticism is almost unprecedented. It looks like Netanyahu is going to be losing his support also amongst the Democrats in Washington.
Many of whom, including the vice president, have said they're not coming to his speech before Congress next week.
Exactly. To pile irony upon embarrassment, that he also refused an invitation to address Democrats in a private meeting because he said he didn't want to appear partisan. So, super diplomatic from Mr. Netanyahu. Look, clearly, we're in election season. Israel is going to the polls on the 17th of March. Netanyahu has put all his eggs in one basket, and that is a security basket. He says he will look after all of Israel's eggs very securely. He has nothing else to offer. I mean, today there was a damning report on the state of housing and how unaffordable it is in Israel. Netanyahu's response, semi-laughably, was to say, well, houses are important, but life is more important, and I will save your life because I care about Iran's bomb. I mean, that is the level he is campaigning on.
Well, who can argue with that?
Right.
I mean, Samira, Benjamin Netanyahu has spent his entire career resembling a man yet to get to page two of How to Win Friends and Influence People. Do we get the sense that he actually believes any of what he's saying about Iran, or is this just electioneering?
I don't think it's just electioneering, because it's been seen, over the course of his administration, he's been sort of leading the drum roll for war with Iran for years now, actually. And so it's not new. I mean, I think it's natural in any election campaign anywhere in the world that people sort of hype up their big issues around an election time. And as Daniela said, this is his thing, really, isn't it? In the midst of huge discontent with rising social inequality in Israel and sort of personal scandals about Netanyahu's expenditure. And there was, I think, last week or the week before, quite a damning report about him and his wife living in this extraordinarily extravagant lifestyle while people are very angry about things like house prices. I think it would be inaccurate to say that he doesn't believe that this is a really existential threat. And I think, though, that his tactic in going about it and sort of ending up alienating the White House and sort of huge swathes of the Democratic Party who probably did support him, and some of those Democrats who are wavering and thinking maybe they'd go against Obama and vote in favour of further sanctions are now sort of so affronted that they've been sort of pushed back into the Obama camp. So it's quite counterproductive.
But Daniela, is it possible, and I'll confess to speaking slightly hopefully here, that this may somewhat go off in Netanyahu's face as an electoral tactic? Because though Israel obviously prides itself on an ability to defend itself and look after itself, there's no getting around the fact that a big part of its security arrangement is this perception of an indestructible relationship with the United States. Is Netanyahu likely to start worrying people back home if he starts annoying America this much?
Well, this is something that the opposition candidates have been trying to play on, the fact that his foreign policy, and certainly with Avigdor Lieberman as a foreign minister, has not exactly endeared Israel to the rest of the world. I mean, followers of Israeli politics for weeks and weeks now have been trying to play this rather desperate numbers game, because it's not, in the Israeli election system, it's not who wins the most votes, it's who's most able to form a coalition. Now, the chances of the Labour centrist bloc forming a coalition seem, every calculation you do, seem much more unlikely than an extremely right-wing bloc. Now, to that right-wing bloc, security is everything. And the idea of Israel standing strong in the world is a bonus, really. I mean, in fact, when I think of one of Netanyahu's recent election campaigns, one of his spoof videos opens with him on the phone, apparently to the White House, saying, "Mr. President, we will not compromise our security." I mean, that's his unique selling point.
He is the man to whom the whole world looks like a nail when all he owns is a hammer. Samira, some of the rhetoric from America, given that this is Israel they're talking about, has been astonishing. We've had the National Security Advisor Susan Rice saying that Netanyahu's visit is destructive to the fabric of the relationship. Biden, as we said earlier, and other Democrats won't go to his speech. Obama won't even speak to him. And it's no secret that Obama and Netanyahu can't stand each other personally. Does this, I guess, lull, you could call it, is this the kind of thing that will be being regarded with a certain amount of mirth in Tehran? Will they see this as an opportunity to split those against them?
I mean, it's possible, but I think that the fact is that the White House would never, you know, the state of American politics is such that I don't think the White House would ever disassociate from Israel or go back on that alliance in any meaningful way, whatever the personal dislike between the two leaders. So I think any mirth in Tehran would probably be quite short-lived. I mean, they might well be enjoying the spectacle, but I think that actually it would be probably quite silly to take too much delight in it, because it's possible that what Netanyahu's trying to do is sort of really push for tougher sanctions and working to toughen the line on these negotiations. I mean, he might not want the negotiations to be happening at all, but it's possible that he'll be able to pressure the US administration into taking a tougher line than they might have otherwise.
Daniela, a final thought on this, and I'll ask the always interesting question of whether somewhere under all this bluster, Netanyahu does have kind of a point. Wouldn't a nuclear-armed Iran actually complete, as people to the left of Netanyahu have also suggested, would it not completely undermine the idea of Israel as a Jewish safe haven?
I think it would undermine the idea of Israel as a haven. I think the existential threat, certainly as it's perceived in Israel, is real, and it extends from the right to the left. I mean, there's an absolute consensus that Iran is an existential threat. The question is how you deal with that. Now, to be fair to Netanyahu, which I think we should be, this is something that has obsessed him for nearly 20 years, in his previous administration as well. He was talking about the threat from Iran before it was fashionable to do so. But his approach, I think, plays into a very Israeli way of looking at it, us against the world. We have to look after ourselves because no one will stand up for us. And the idea that it's possible to solve problems with unilateral action rather than multinational negotiation. Now, that is really Netanyahu summed up in a nutshell.
Okay, we will doubtless have further opportunity to discuss that, especially as Israel's election on March 17th draws nearer. We will now look at Greece, where since left-wing populist Syriza were elected last month, most coverage of their new government has focused on their showdown with the Eurozone. Rather less attention has been paid to their progressive immigration policy, at least relative to previous Greek governments. Syriza has pledged to close Greece's detention centres for illegal immigrants and replace them with better-equipped reception centres. Samir, is the difference between a detention and a reception centre entirely semantic?
It can be, but I think that the detention centres in Greece are essentially prison camps, and they're pretty appalling conditions by any stretch of the imagination. They're often operating in violation of international law by keeping people there for indefinite periods and so on. So I think if all of those things are fixed, then that's a real positive. And that's what the new migration minister has been talking about, is enforcing not only Greek law but also international law to make it a sort of more generally humane situation for migrants. Because I think in the past, especially in recent years with austerity, Greek policy, or at least Greek authorities' actions on migrants, has been pretty extreme. You know, we've lots of reports of pushbacks from the borders, which is hugely illegal, and you're essentially sending people to their deaths when they've come on these perilous sea routes, sort of erecting fences and so on. So I think any moves to bring Greece into line with laws basically is a good thing.
Daniela, though, is there any way for a government to actually win with this one? Because it's something that, I mean, this will dominate increasingly. We'll be hearing more about this in Britain over the next 3 months as an election looms here. In my own homeland of Australia, it's an absolutely unceasing argument that if you're too welcoming and too humane, it encourages further illegal immigrants. And of course, if you go out of your way to discourage illegal immigration, you get yourself into a fairly strange area fairly quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think as Samira said, in Greece, you know, the baseline has been set so low in the last 2 or 3 years that any improvement, I mean, just actually keeping to international and even national standards will be a massive improvement. I mean, Greece has got very porous borders. It's really been on the front line of changes and population shifts in recent years. So it needs a proper policy. It needs a consistent policy. How realistic this is, given Syriza's coalition partners, who are not terribly immigrant-friendly, I would imagine.
They're not the most enthusiastic of advocates for multiculturalism.
Right.
No.
That's also very, 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 very well put. But I mean, this is the case of any immigration policy. The trying to narrow the difference between principle and practicality and reality. But anything that sort of shifts away from really populist moves, I think, and I agree, that's a very, very good move.
You mentioned Greece's porous borders, which they are, but they're not the only porous borders within Europe. We've seen in the last few months 50,000 people have left Kosovo legally, and less so for Western Europe. Isn't the trouble, I'll put this to you, Samira, that the EU by its nature, with its open borders, it could have been set up to encourage illegal immigration, or the open borders coupled with the fact that governments tend by and large not to want to touch this because, again, you get into a weird area quite quickly?
I think it's complicated, but then I think we've got a situation at the moment where you have EU states sort of trying to shift the blame onto each other about immigration, and each sort of just trying to shunt the immigrants along. And I think when you've got people legitimately fleeing persecution and war, that's a really dire situation. When you've got sort of Greece, Bulgaria, Turkey, whatever it is, just sort of holding people in centres, pushing them along. I mean, you've seen the recent sort of tensions between France and England about how migrants are ending up here and so on. So I think it's quite difficult, as with any area of contentious policy, to balance the policies of individual member states with the sort of broader EU policy. But I think that generally there could be a little bit more humaneness in the way this is tackled. And I think, just coming back to Greece, that it goes a lot deeper than the recent shifts in population, I think. Yeah, one of the things which I think is quite telling was that the new government wants to introduce is a law that would allow the children of immigrants, so people who have been born and brought up in Greece, to have Greek passports, which they're not currently allowed to do, which I think is quite extraordinary if you compare that to here or to anywhere else. So, you know, someone could have spent their entire life in Greece and never known anywhere else and yet not be allowed to be Greek.
Daniela, you have a piece in the current print issue of Monocle about immigration and Israel. Netanyahu, him again, in somewhat questionable taste, used last month's events in Paris to call upon more of Europe's Jews to move to Israel. Isn't the problem, though, that Israel is actually having difficulty keeping a lot of the people it has?
Well, there aren't really any reliable statistics on this, how many Israelis are moving abroad. A lot of Israelis have second passports, European passports, but this is really more to do with ease of work and movement, travel, rather than looking for a bolt hole. I think one of the problems Israel faces, and this is shared by many countries with immigration issues, is the idea of national identity in a country, in a place where national identity is a little fluid and people feel a little precarious, the idea of who can become one of us, you know, and who is a welcome migrant and who can stay and who needs to leave, is very difficult. And it's about perception as much as any real danger of jobs or resources or anything like that. And I think in Israel, that's a particular issue because people are really not sure who is an Israeli. They're not even sure who is a Jew.
Final thought on this, Samira. In Britain, new immigration figures have just suggested that net migration last year was 298,000 people coming in, up 42% on the previous year, despite no ifs, no buts promised to reduce it from the Prime Minister, David Cameron. The reality is, though, is that not in an open border Europe, all such promises are fairly meaningless, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. And when the coalition came to power and the Conservatives were pledging, I think, to get net migration down to the tens of thousands, I think it's clearly completely implausible thing to promise when you do have open borders with Europe. And I think that's why we've seen quite excessively harsh measures on people coming from outside Europe, which is pretty detrimental to all sorts of areas like the NHS, which depends on doctors and nurses coming from Africa and Asia. When you've got sort of very, very strict guidelines on that, on things like spousal visas and sort of a real minority of people, and yet you can't sort of shut the borders to Europe. So I think it's just silly to try and talk in those terms, really.
We're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with our guests Samira Shackle and Daniela Pellad. When we return, we'll be taking a look at Austria's approach to Islam as it approves reform of an old law to much international criticism.
Broadcasting around the clock from our headquarters at Midori House in London, Monocle 24 is the global radio service of Monocle magazine and a wholly owned subsidiary of Wing Content. With bureau in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Istanbul, Zurich, New York and Toronto, and a network of over 35 correspondents, Monocle 24 is edited by Tyler Brulee, Andrew Tuck, Steve Bloomfield and Tom Edwards. If you have any editorial, programming or advertising inquiries, please contact us at info@monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
The idea behind the Foreign Desk is very simple. We take one issue each week, find people who know all about it, and then let them talk.
He was one of the few leaders who didn't have blood on his hands. All the warlords had committed crimes against other ethnic groups.
There are no sound bites, we don't want to set up arguments, we just want to explore some pretty complex issues with some great guests who can explain things in plain English.
For as long as I've been involved with the Security Council, Russia has frankly been malign in its intent. I don't think it's ever done anything good or useful on the Council.
Sometimes it's the big news story, sometimes we pick a subject that no one else is covering. Either way, we do it in depth.
He promised to eliminate poppy cultivation and the trafficking of drugs. Last year saw a record harvest in Afghanistan. I think it was worth almost $1 billion.
That's The Foreign Desk with me, Steve Bloomfield, airing every Saturday at 12 noon London time. Also available at any time on monocle.com.
And welcome back to Midori House. Still with me are Samira Shackle and Daniela Pellad. Now, there's not much that the Habsburg Empire did a century or so ago still regarded as a model of good governance. However, after annexing Bosnia in 1912, Franz Josef passed a law making Islam an official religion in Austria and guaranteeing certain rights for its adherents. That law is now being updated to less than universal acclaim from Muslims inside Austria and out. Samira, I'll ask you first. Austria wants to protect religious holidays, make training of imams more widely available, apart from other things. What's the problem with any of this?
The problem is that they are limiting foreign funding for all Muslim organisations and not for Christian or Jewish organisations. So I think while the government is understandably playing up those positive elements, like the legal protection that it gives to religious holidays and so on, I think that we should be very, very cautious about condoning anything that singles out one religious group over any other, especially since Austria hasn't particularly had any problems with sort of integration of Muslim communities. It's quite a sizable minority at 6%. So I think anything that targets one group in a way that is completely different to any other group in society is something that should be that's quite worrying.
Daniela, that is the thing that has got people mildly upset, this ban on foreign contributions to religious organisations. But it is the case, is it not, that there are certain Middle Eastern governments who do make contributions to Muslim organisations in Europe who are not necessarily entirely, well, their motives are not necessarily entirely trustworthy. Is this necessarily a bad idea?
Well, I mean, if we're talking about, for instance, Saudi Arabia, who's...
To choose an example, more or less at random.
Yeah. Yes, other regimes are also available. As far as I'm aware, Austria has very cordial relations diplomatically with Saudi Arabia. It has more issues with Turkey, you know, historically, and that's where most of the Austrian Muslims come from. But obviously Austria is very, very against Turkey joining the EU, but I'm not aware of any famous problems with the Turkish government funding militant Islam. I think it's another in the very clumsy ways that countries in Europe are trying to kind of create a state version, a European version of Islam.
Indeed, part of this is the standardised German Quran is part of the plan.
Yeah, this hasn't worked. This has never worked. I mean, it reminds me, in fact, of the Soviet states where there was going to be an official Islam, and it's still carried on in the post-Soviet states. It hasn't worked there either. I mean, when it comes to actual any benefit or any impact this would have on radicalisation, I can't see any, but I can see it as a reaction, the government reacting to people saying something needs to be done, so it's doing something, and that therefore appeases a large number of its constituency who sort of have a general worry or fear of what might be happening.
Samira, elaborating on that note, is this move and moves like it, and we've seen similar noises emanating from France in the last few weeks in particular, what are they really trying to discourage? Is it militant Islamism or far-right reaction to it? Because in Austria you have the Freedom Party, who inevitably think this doesn't go nearly far enough.
I think there's probably a bit of both, as there always is. But I think that as Daniela rightly says, it's quite clumsy. And I think that the potential risks of taking a move like this, it's about the singling out, I think, which if you have people who are already maybe feeling a little bit disempowered or a little bit targeted, I think you can have a completely the opposite effect to what you desire if you continue to label that group of people as suspect. And so, you know, I think for the vast majority of people, it might not make that much difference to their daily lives, to Austrian Muslims. But I think that segment of the population who already feels sort of victimised, I don't think that there is enough benefit to justify that potential risk. And, you know, you do have Muslims across Europe feeling pretty under siege and being the target of far-right attack and criticism. And you know, this is not small populations and sort of individual terrorists I'm talking about. I'm talking about sort of grandparents, mums, dads, millions of people, or at least hundreds of thousands in the case of Austria. So I think that, I just don't think it's sensible.
Okay, well, finally tonight, and briefly tonight, Islamic State's most infamous killer has today been unmasked, figuratively, if not literally. The Washington Post has identified the star of several IS snuff videos as a Kuwaiti-born 20-something Londoner called Mohammed Mwazi. Daniela, he's a... Not for the first time, we have a Western-raised jihadi who turns out to have had an almost tediously normal, middle-class, relatively prosperous upbringing. Does anything in his backstory surprise us?
Well, it seems to have surprised a lot of people in the media and on social media today, but I don't see why. I think anybody who's going to go to Islamic State and take a prominent role is going to be driven by ideology. There's no lack of foot soldiers going there for what they might perceive as an adventure. But I think the people who are running the show and the people who are involved are not, perhaps because we find the idea of Islamic State so frightening, we want to think that the people involved in it are ignorant or stupid or just somehow bestial. But actually they are people, I wouldn't say just like you or I, but they are people with educated people, people from a Western, people from all kinds of backgrounds. I don't think it's surprising at all that this guy grew up not very far away from where I grew up in London, attended a school I'm very familiar with, went to university I'm very familiar with. I think that's also what is really frightening, because he could be any one of the guys that we pass on the street we pass on the street in London or any European capital.
And final thought from you on this, Samira. Cage UK, the advocacy group with whom Mr. Emwazi had some contact, have today been trying to play up the whole he was a terribly nice boy who became radicalised because he was hassled by the man thing. Are we buying that, or is the simpler explanation that fits the facts more likely to be accurate, i.e. that, you know, he's just awful?
Yeah, I think the latter is certainly more likely to be accurate because, you know, he's, as Daniela says, he's not someone who's a foot soldier who's sort of taking actions he doesn't really understand. This is someone who's really at the forefront of the social media campaign, of the brutality, of the violence, and it's someone who's obviously quite engaged in what he's doing. So I think it's a sort of really bizarre move by KGK, who I think probably do some valuable work in other aspects. I think it's quite undermining to sort of claim him as the most notorious terrorist who's sort of been filmed actually committing horrendous acts of brutality, and to suggest that it's somehow the fault of the authorities.
We will have to leave it there. Samira Shackle and Daniela Pellad, thank you both very much for joining us. There's plenty still coming up in the second half of today's show, starting with what the French weeklies are saying.
On the menu, we explore the delicious, diverse, and eminently digestible world of food, drink, and hospitality every week. Join me, Marcus Hippi, as I meet everyone from the bakers to the makers who are redefining the culinary landscape.
Many people think that it might be gamey somehow because these are hairy animals that have horns, but it's quite the opposite. I think the milk has a cleaner, sweeter flavor than cow milk.
We'll also head to Kenji's kitchen for a roundup of restaurant reviews, interviews with top chefs, and trade secrets with our Asia editor at large, Kenji Hall, in Tokyo and beyond.
The beer market has been changing rapidly for some time now. It seems like almost every month, a new pub that specializes in craft beer is opening.
All that and even a dinner party soundtrack recommendation, so your ears are catered for as well as your belly. A healthy serving of the finest free-range fare to sate your radio appetite each week. That's the menu on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House. You're live on Monocle 24. It's 21:32 in Moscow, 18:32 here in London, 16:32 in Rio de Janeiro. It's time now to leaf through the weekly printed press from one corner of the world. Today we're looking at France, and I'm joined by Bénédicte Pavillot, UK correspondent for France 24. Bénédicte, welcome to the programme. What are we starting with today?
We're starting with a very interesting article in Le Figaro magazine. It's the cover story. It's about France's Jews. And its headline there is, "Our Country is Here." And of course, this is following the terrible attack on Charlie Hebdo on the 7th of January, and then the assaults by
Indeed
French police
so.
On the Friday 9th, which of course comprehensively covered here on Monocle. What's interesting is that this article actually has gone all over, the journalists of Le Figaro magazine have gone all over France. They've spoken to Jews in Paris, in the Paris region. They've gone to the France profonde, so the deep heart of France. And they say that the overwhelming message of French Jews is actually, despite the fear that there could be other attacks, and despite the call of Benjamin Netanyahu for them to go back to Israel, is that they're in their immense majority, in their great majority, French Jews want to stay in France. Very interesting examples that they give about how various people who are French Jews, whose parents have come either from Israel, from Hungary, etc., feel that they are French, and they do not understand why people ask them, you know, do you feel more Jewish? Do you feel French? How come you don't want to go back to Israel? Moving examples of people who said, you know, I would die for this country. Another person saying, I fought in the Second World War for this country. I'm proud of being French. I would go all the way to being killed. I sing the Marseillaise.
It's nice to see as an exercise in proper weekly journalism. As you say, they've gone all over France to speak to people. But I also like stories like this because they remind that what you see on the news hour in and hour out is the extreme, because that's what the news is attracted to. I kind of like every so often reading a story that just reminds you, you know what, most people are basically okay, and which is what this one seems to be doing.
Yes, and it's not, we're not, this is not rose-tinted glasses. This is proper journalism here. And indeed, they've got a really interesting side to this angle, other angle to this story. A man called Johann Durai, who was in that, in the basement of that Jewish deli, and who says himself, you know, I almost died in there. And he said he thought they were going to die when they were released, interesting detail, by the police, and they were faced with all these guns when the door was finally opened. He looked down at his belly, and what did he see? 12 red dots. And of course, they were the police, and his reaction was to put his hands up. I mean, they were being saved, and they'd been down there for 6 hours. Put up his hand and said, it's not us, c'est pas nous. And he says, you know, I grew up, it's not about being Jewish, not being Jewish. I grew up in Belleville, which is in the Paris. And, you know, I never worried about whether I was Jewish or other people were Jewish. I'm French, you know, and I want to live here. I don't want to live in a climate of insecurity. So it's a really interesting, I recommend it,
okay.
Interesting work done by Michael Ben David, is the the journalist who's done this enquête.
Okay, that's Le Figaro. What else is in the sheaf?
Well, let's look at L'Obs, page 10. The man Hervé Falciani, another man who has now got a worldwide reputation. Who is he? Well, he's the man who in 2009, that's ex-employee of HSBC, and of course we've seen the chairman...
they're having a bad week.
They're having more than a bad week. They've had bad press, etc. And so various facts that we didn't know about him. Well, he always goes around on a scooter. He always has his computer with him. He's actually quite stubborn. The way he first... interestingly, he hasn't just now been collaborating with France, Italy and the United States, or indeed the anti-corruption fraud police in Spain, but he says he's had new requests of collaboration from India and from Argentina. Another thing here where it says that an ex, possibly lover, or certainly a woman who was in love with him, is now going to be testifying against him. There's also an accusation that at first Hervé Falciani tried to sell the data that he'd stolen from HSBC, and that there was some mysterious trip, did you know this, to Lebanon in February 2008. So it's this colleague of his, Georgina Michael, who apparently was this colleague who was in love with him, who's now going to testify against him. Testify where? In Switzerland, because there is the Swiss think he's an absolute traitor. There's a surprise after all the data he's given. And he is now going to be, well, he's accused of espionage, economic espionage, and of course violating the banking secrets of Switzerland. So a lot of interesting stuff. And also he compares himself, or is being compared to really Snowden, Edward Snowden, the American, of course, who has revealed the NSA secrets. So, I mean, he certainly is a wanted man by many people. And I'm sure he's quite, I'm sure a few HSBC bosses would like to see him behind bars. But he's not about to go to Switzerland because, of course, he knows or he believes that he would be jailed.
Not without reason, I suspect. I want to move along finally to Marianne because I do want to know what President Hollande has been texting people.
Well, it's absolutely fascinating because some would say it's actually quite unwise. He's kept his same mobile phone number. Yeah. We know it begins with 06.
What could go wrong?
What could go wrong? Because mobile's always... But the next number is 32, so we've already got four digits. and so the thing that everybody says to themselves, have you had a message from 32? And apparently, with great pride, a lot of journalists say, yeah, I've had 70. So he is texting constantly, and it's interesting, though, even in big meetings, very important meetings around the world, and some are saying that this is A, unwise because the line is not safe.
Well, obviously.
So he could be hacked into.
I would be astonished if he hadn't been.
Well, maybe he has, and we're about to find out. And then, of course, there's the other aspect of he's sounding off in these text messages. And, of course, we know the ex-First Lady, Valérie Trier-Vallière, has said prominently in her book that she was being pursued by the French president.
And what kind of texts are these? He's not having a few drinks late at night and then texting people, because that never ends well.
No, but he is, he's trying to be, on the one hand, quite pally. He's trying to, some say, be quite strategic, etc. But it's apparently it's nothing to worry about. Or that's the defence that's coming out of the Élysée Palace.
And that's in Marianne Benedict. Pavio, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Up next, we meet the author of a book about a story bizarre even by the formidable standards of North Korea.
From Monday the 2nd of March, Monocle 24 will be sounding even smarter and sharper thanks to a fresh new season lineup. Hear Monocle's editors in conversation with inspirational names every week on The Big Interview. We'll look back at the news week that was on The Recap. Our brilliant musical guests get a billing of their own on the sessions at Midori House. All this alongside our unrivaled mix of tracks and insight and opinion from Monocle's bureau around the globe. Tune in and listen today at monocle.com via our app or on iTunes or SoundCloud. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take five times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's normal anxiety.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor, Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House, 1841 here in London, 341 in Pyongyang. Now, the late and generally unlamented North Korean despot Kim Jong-il was, despite his bellicosity towards the West, an immense fan of the cinema of the capitalist running dog. He is reputed to have owned more than 20,000 videos and DVDs, was a particular fan of Sean Connery and Elizabeth Taylor, and wrote several fabulously tedious treatises on film. Not content, however, with watching from the stalls, Kim fancied himself as an auteur, and to this end, in the late 70s, he arranged the kidnapping of South Korea's most famous actress and most acclaimed director. This bizarre tale is now recounted in A Kim Jong-il Production, the incredible true story of North Korea and the most audacious kidnapping in history. Its author, Paul Fisher, joins me now. It is the story, as the subtitle says, is both incredible and true. Where did you even start trying to tell it? What was the first thread you pulled?
It's the Shin Sang-ok and Choi Yun-hee, who are the filmmaker and the actress, mm-hmm. they wrote an account or had an account ghostwritten of what they said happened in South Korea. And so I started with that and then tried to, you know, poke holes into it, unravel it, find things that may match other things. And you know, essentially tried to find what, and they're a very factual account, you know, it's very dry, where a narrative would be and where it fit into how North Korea came to be and how it matched other accounts. The first thing was to try and figure out if it was true, because a lot of people I'd spoken to who were experts would tell me that, you know, oh, I don't know if that's true. I hear they've defected and they weren't actually kidnapped.
This is always the trouble with North Korea, though, isn't it? It's just what actually happens that we know of is so bizarre that anything you can make up seems slightly less incredible, with the result that the media will just disseminate any nonsense anybody cares to invent about the place.
Exactly. And because, you know, in a case like this, whoever goes to North Korea, whether you defect or whether you're kidnapped, you're made to give a press conference saying that you came voluntarily. And once you get out and you go back to South Korea, you're made to give a press conference saying the exact opposite. So everyone's credibility from the start is sort of shot, which is what happened to these guys.
But is the story, without giving away the ending, their story is fundamentally true? They were kidnapped and taken to North Korea in order to make movies for Kim.
That's right, yeah. And there's nothing, you know, I couldn't poke a hole in it. And I tried very, very hard. And there's nothing in the book, you know, that I couldn't corroborate. If I can't corroborate it and I wanted to put it in, I kind of underlined, you know, that this is an allegation, but there's no sort of evidence towards
it. And what, I mean, what kind of films, I mean, it seems almost idle to discuss the quality of the work they created, given that they were victims of a monstrous and peculiar crime. But what kind of films did they end up making?
They made quite a lot. They kind of stuck to propaganda on a superficial sense. But, you know, they made a kung fu film, they made a Godzilla-type monster film, they made a couple of dramas, they made a musical kind of romantic comedy thing. And they had sort of a free hand because Kim Jong-il wanted them to win awards abroad. He wanted to make things that were respected abroad, and he trusted their instinct as long as they didn't kind of obviously break the rules. And it's not so idle a question because, you know, they kind of found a purpose making films for the North Korean people who they saw didn't really have that much relief or excitement or anything in their lives.
So is there anything to be said artistically for the films? If you strip away the deeply weird gestation of them, are they actually good films?
There's one or two that are. And, you know, I'd say all of them are good for the world they were in. You know, to North Korean audiences, they kind of, you know, blew everything open. In the wider world, you know, they made a film called Salt, which is a very kind of harrowing drama about a family suffering through Japanese occupation. That's kind of a very good Asian neorealist experience, and they're very visually sophisticated and competently made.
Okay. Well, but in your sort of reading of their testimony and the other people you spoke to, did you get any, what sense, I guess, did you get of Kim's own cinematic tastes and what he enjoyed?
Well, they were like, Shin, the filmmaker he kidnapped, said they were very much like your average sort of 30-year-old male. And he loved James Bond films and horror films and the Rambo franchise and pretty actresses.
Not sophisticated tastes then?
No, he liked, you know, mainstream, you know, extravagant stuff. But that he still sort of apparently took to be quite realistic and to be kind of docudrama level accurate, even if it was a James Bond film. And that's, you know, something he told Shinri. You know, he gave him the impression that he thought these films were representative of how, you know, reality and these things were done outside of his own borders, because he never left, obviously, really.
That is a terrifying thought, isn't it?
Yeah.
Do we get any sense, again, from the research you did and the people you spoke to, of Kim as a man, as away from being a politician or a cinema buff?
Yeah, the time when he kidnapped them, Kim had two wives, and he'd have a first wife, and you know, there was two households he was keeping hidden from his father and from the public, but he gave them a sort of glimpse into it. And people from that world have escaped and spoken about that time, and you get the sense of someone who was very contradictory and kind of impulsive and emotional. But, you know, the way people describe him, it could describe five different people. And there's only certain key moments where, you know, this dictator son who's a dandy, who's a playboy, who's ruthless, who's violent, who's caring, who's sensitive, who's awful, that all the parts of him kind of come into focus in a way that makes sense. But he just seemed kind of a very contradictory, paradoxical person. And one of the reasons he had to kidnap these two people is because he, you know, needed people to make films that broke the rules that he himself had set, because he didn't believe that he could break them himself without kind of jeopardizing his own hold on power.
But in writing the book, and this is always the difficulty, and we run up against it here when we cover North Korea on Monocle 24, there's the temptation to regard everything as just an immense hoot. There's this enormous Gilbert and Sullivan comic opera quality to North Korea. It is preposterous, and yet it is a ghastly prison state come cult compound where hideous crimes are being committed on a daily basis. When you actually wrote the book, how did you negotiate the balance between the fact that it is just, it's farcical, it's absurd, and the fact that, you know, this is clearly an extremely sad and serious tale?
Right. Well, The second layer that interested me in the book is film and culture kind of played a big role in creating the personality and narrative North Korea has that allows it to do all these awful things, but we see it as an entertaining, over-the-top, hard-to-understand place. And I was interested in how they kind of built that legitimacy and a narrative for themselves. But also, you know, as you say, either we kind of talk about the very harrowing stuff or we kind of talk about the absurd, funny stuff. And for me, it was the moments in the story where the two come together that help to make sense of how it's been going on for so long. You can't really understand it if you ignore either of them, okay. To me.
Final question, which I've just, something I've always been personally curious about. Does anybody ever find out for sure what Kim thought of the best known cinematic rendering of himself, i.e. the puppet in Team America World Police?
Not that I've been able to find out. but he seemed less offended than his son is about films.
His son does seem somewhat touchy on the subject, but, you know, everyone's a critic. Paul Fisher, author of A Kim Jong-il Production, The Incredible True Story of North Korea and the Most Audacious Kidnapping in History, out now or now abouts. Thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Time now for some music, staying more or less on the theme of our last topic. This is Black Box Recorder with Kidnapping an Heiress.
Born into money, it's not a crime. You can fool the people all the time. 900 dead in Jonestown. Rescued from a shopping mall.
Haynes, John Moore and Sarah Nixie, otherwise known as Black Box Recorder, with Kidnapping an Heiress. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. It's time now for our daily arts review. Today we're talking books, and we're talking them again with Anne Meadows, editor at Granta and Portobello. Anne, welcome back to the show. I wanted to talk about... I've been talking for nearly an hour now. You can tell, can't you? I wanted to start with Grégoire Chamaillot's A Theory of the Drone, by which he means the unmanned aerial vehicle. And this is an idea which I know is interesting military theorists and indeed other professional observers. This idea that are we reaching the end of manned aerial warfare and indeed possibly manned warfare?
Possibly. I mean, Chamaillot, I'm probably pronouncing that wrong, but Chamaillot's thesis is that the drone is changing war itself, but it's also changing the state. So everyone knows that drones are used in Pakistan and in Yemen, particularly by the American government, and that they are used to assassinate. But I think what really shocked me about this book is that what we don't think about is the fact that drones are also used for surveillance. I mean, they're in the air constantly above these villages. Everyone is being watched, and then they're deployed and people are killed. And Chamaillot kind of dissects this. He's a philosopher, and he thinks about the myths around drones. We assume they're precise. We assume that they are almost like the lasers that snipers have. You know, they take one person out and that person was bad and they're gone. But actually, he shows that the drone as a weapon of war is incredibly imprecise. You know, it has a kill zone of sort of 20 meters and people are taken out. And often the government doesn't know who they are. They're just classified as militants. So this is a book that I read recently and I feel very passionately about, and I feel passionately that everyone should read it because it's so shocking what's being done effectively in our names. But yes, it's definitely changing the nature of warfare.
Because it has made warfare strangely unaccountable to the side controlling the drone, hasn't it? And there have been a lot of studies about, or a lot of discussion now about what it does psychologically to somebody who is at war without being at war. The pilot who flies a drone from a base underground in Nevada flies lethal operations over Afghanistan and then just clocks off and goes home.
Absolutely. And so these pilots are living a kind of double life where in the day they're leaving their humanity behind. And the way they describe it, they actually don't suffer from very much post-traumatic stress because they're not being exposed to danger. But they do have this kind of bifurcation of their identities where they're killers, but they're killers who seem to be doing no more than playing a computer game. And they describe it, and Chamaillot describes it as kind of like playing a computer game, except that somewhere someone dies. And one of his very interesting theses is that drones will change the nature of the state itself, that traditionally the state relied upon its citizens to kind of curtail it. You know, you as a citizen may have to go to war, so you have a voice in that war and you have a way of holding back your government. And, you know, the protests over Vietnam were an example of that, of the ordinary populace really holding the government to account. With drones, if the populace is no longer in danger, if the soldiers are no longer in danger, there's no curtail on state power, and you get a new kind of imperialism where governments can march over borders, they can fly anywhere in the world and kill anyone they want, and there's almost no accountability.
Okay, that's a theory of the drone by Grégoire Chamaillou. I want to move along to another, I guess, kind of contradictory or at least contrarian philosophical tract. This is Katrine Markels, who cooked Adam Smith's dinner. Adam Smith, of course, being the arch-economic rationalist Scottish economic philosopher who said that basically everything we do to for our own benefit, and quite rightly, because the whole invisible hand thing provides for everybody in the end.
Yeah, that was Adam Smith's theory. And while he was writing it, so he wrote that the butcher and the baker, you get your dinner on the table because they act in their own interest, that it's pure selfishness, or largely pure selfishness. But while he was writing that, he was also living with his mother. And he lived with his mother for his whole life, and I think one of his cousins, and they got his dinner on the table. So the answer to who cooked Adam Smith's dinner is his mother, and she did it for free, and she did not do it out of her own self-interest. She was not being paid. And this book looks at the work that women have always done. Women have always worked, but they have not always been paid for it. And it looks at care, and it looks at cooking, and it looks at raising children. And it says that our whole idea of economics, which is based around profit, is false, because actually people have always worked for free, and they've always worked out of generosity, and they've always worked to keep society going. And as someone who is in publishing and an arts job, you know, I am very aware every day that I'm not just working for profit. If I was, I would go into banking.
Well, indeed, I think you could tell that to a lot of people who work in journalism as well. We're going to finish with Signs Preceding the End of the World by Yuri Herrera. This is, it's a meditation, I guess, a fictional meditation on the border between between Mexico and the United States, which is, it's a ceaselessly interesting border to a lot of people, because I think probably aside from the DMZ in Korea, it's the one place where the third world runs up directly against the first.
Yeah, it's a fascinating border. And this is a great read. This is a 100-page novel which kind of reinvents the apocalypse, I guess. And it starts with this sinkhole opening in the ground and swallowing this old man. And this woman sees it. Her name's Makina. And she's on this odyssey across the border to find her brother who's gone to the States, you know, the promised land. And she does follow him, and she's shot at, and she's chased, and she's this incredible voice. And I won't spoil it by saying what happens, but it starts with the sinkhole opening in the ground, and it only gets darker from there.
And that sounds like another enthusiastic recommendation as well.
Definitely, definitely.
Well, that's 3 out of 3. That's Signs Preceding the End of the World, Yuri Herrera, third and final choice of our guest book reviewer, Anne Meadows from Granta and Portobello. Thank you for joining us. That's all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. My thanks to our earlier guests, Samira Shackle and Daniela Pellet. The show was produced by Alice Block, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Lara Kunze, and our studio manager was Wei Dong Lin. Next up, after the headlines, The Urbanist, presented by Andrew Tuck. At 2200 hours, I'm back with Georgina Godwin for the Monocle Daily. I'm also back with Midori House at the same time, 1800 London, tomorrow. But for this edition, it's goodbye, and thanks for listening.
London.
To New York.
To Tokyo.
To Shanghai.
To Berlin.
To Tel Aviv.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.